From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. And now more than ever, we need you to join our other generous listeners who make this show possible. For information on making a tax-deductible donation, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
The shock value has worn off long ago, but the blatant assault on the human dignity and rights of Muslims by this administration continues to impact millions of people in both obvious and subtler ways solely because of their faith. What could be more un-American than that? This weekend marks the first anniversary of the Trump Muslim ban, and a broad multi-faith coalition is observing it with a dramatic action in front of the White House. We'll get details from Patrick Carolan, Executive Director of the Franciscan Action Network.
In Mississippi, a new law allows businesses and government workers to refuse service to gays based on their religious beliefs.
As the U.S. Supreme Court took, or rather failed to take, action on Mississippi's notorious anti-gay religious freedom law, it's a good time to evaluate how these justices are likely to address other religious liberty questions coming their way this session. With the other branches of our government in hopeless partisan gridlock, can the court still rise above? I'll get the thoughts of activist, author, and attorney Rabbi Jay Michelson. But first,
the March for Life may be the year's biggest pro-life event.
Celebrities, politicians joining the many women's marches.
A week ago, last Friday, thousands gathered on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. for the annual anti-abortion protest. The event included a message from President Donald Trump to the marchers. The next day, the first anniversary of this president's inauguration was marked with gigantic women-led protests nationwide, including in our nation's capital. Many participants were motivated by what they see as misogyny on the part of this administration. Now, where do these two worlds overlap, or do they? That's the question Jack Jenkins explored for Religion News Service in an article that garnered an awful lot of attention, and I'm happy to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Jack, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your article is headlined, "Anti-Abortion Democrats Navigate Divide Between March for Life and the Women's March."
Well, I mean, you know, when it comes to people who are trying to navigate between those two marches, that might be a relatively small group of people. You know, the article talks about Kristen Day, which is the executive director of Democrats for Life of America, and she actually went to both marches last year, but after having a bad experience at the women's march because she was holding a sign that was anti-abortion, she only went to the March for Life this year. But in terms of Democrats who hold anti-abortion views, that's actually not an insignificant portion of the Democratic Party. According to 2017 Pew Research surveys, around 22% of Democrats believe that abortion should be illegal in all or most cases. So this isn't necessarily a small group of people for Democrats, you know, in terms of who shows up to the ballot box.
You highlight several women's experiences that underscore the challenge they face when they identify as anti-abortion feminists. You've just told us one experience like that. Talk about that some more, if you would.
There are challenges here, because for people who identify as both, quote-unquote, pro-life or, you know, anti-abortion, and as a Democrat, they're often not necessarily the same kind of quote-unquote pro-life voter that you find in the Republican Party, right? A lot of times you'll find people on the conservative end of the spectrum prioritize voting on abortion as their number one voting priority. It's something that they push as how they cast their vote. Whereas Democrats seem to have a much more, you know, complicated look if they are also anti-abortion in terms of what issues they care about. A lot of Democrats believe in science and climate change. Anti-abortion Democrats also believe that life begins in the womb. Yeah. These people also support minimum wage increases. They believe in maternity wave, and they believe in immigration reform. But when it comes to the topic of abortion, they feel as though they take an anti-abortion position, often described as pro-life. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the Women's March, these are people who believe very firmly that women should be paid equally, that they should be equal status in society, that women's liberation is a key idea, and they consider themselves as part of the progressive movement, but they feel ostracized along this one issue of abortion.
Mm-hmm. So is there overlap from the other side? You talk about what Democratic women believe. Do you get the same amount of diversity of interest coming from those who are just in the anti-abortion march?
It doesn't seem to be the case in the other direction. It does seem to be that if you fall on the conservative end of the spectrum, there was some polling done on this, particularly, you know, using the example of the recent Alabama Senate race between Roy Moore and Doug Jones. Some pollsters actually argued that whereas several people expected the abortion issue to play a big role in that race, it turned out to not be the case because for Doug Jones, the people who vote on abortion as their preeminent issue are typically conservative and not, quote unquote, gettable voters for Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't see the same diversity of thought in terms of issue interests on the conservative side alongside abortion, or if they do, you know, also believe that climate change is real and caused by humans, and they believe in other progressive ideals, those issues fall far behind the issue of abortion, which is not necessarily the case for anti-abortion Democrats.
Yeah. When you wrote this piece, were you inspired by your observations of what was happening, or did you also have some interviews that encouraged you to write the piece?
You know, obviously one of the emphases to write the piece was the fact that the March for Life falls alongside the Women's March. But there actually has been a lot of conversation about this issue over the past year. Mm-hmm. There have been people who, particularly in the sort of faith space, who have been talking about how Democrats need to take this seriously as an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So Michael Weir, who's the former faith outreach director for Barack Obama's 2012 re-election campaign, has written about the idea that the Democrats need to take quote-unquote pro-life voters more seriously or risk hemorrhaging some groups. And
mm-hmm.
around last summer, we actually had, and last spring, there was actually a lot of back and forth in the party over whether or not there was a quote-unquote litmus test on the issue of abortion for Democrats who were running for Congress in 2018. And you kind of got conflicting information depending on which prominent Democrat you were speaking with.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it seems as though major Democratic strategists have taken the tact of, no, there isn't a litmus test for Democrats running in 2018, that it, you know, you can be, quote-unquote, pro-life or pro-choice publicly, and the Democratic Party will probably embrace you as long as you line up with other elements of the Democratic platform. But, you know, that debate going back and forth, I think, is a live question in the minds of several Democratic strategists looking towards November, because it comes down to, is this a political risk to try to suss out where the Democratic Party firmly stands on this issue, or is it something that isn't that big of a deal? And so that, for me, was part of the impetus to write this piece, was there's some talk about these people, but it's still not entirely clear how they're going to vote on Election Day, if they'll vote for Democrats or Republicans or just not show up at all.
Hmm. So, Jack, tell me, what are your own thoughts on bridging this divide? Is it possible the way you see it?
I think so. I think from what I can hear from these groups like Democrats for Life and all these faith-based advocates, they don't seem to be necessarily leaving the party as of yet. Mm-hmm. There may be a subset that has, and that has fled Democrats on its own, but they haven't left the party just yet. And it's important to note that just being a person of faith does not mean that you believe abortion should be illegal in all or most cases. Mm-hmm. Majorities of the United Methodists, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Church of Christ, you know, Episcopalians, the African American Methodist Episcopal Church, majorities of those denominations believe that abortion should be legal in all or most cases, according to 2014 data from Pew. So there's a way to actually have a faith-rooted conversation about this issue that doesn't alienate someone because of their faith, mm-hmm. per se. Mm-hmm. But for me, as I look at this data and as I look at these interviews, I think the more important question for political strategists is whether or not this is an issue that's going to impact the electorate this year, and whether or not they should be concerned about how it impacts things in 2020 and 2024. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're looking at a situation now where the most animated part of the electorate seem to be, you know, diehard progressives. So you see these big swings in Virginia and the loss of Roy Moore in Alabama to Democrat Doug Jones that were arguably pushed by a lot of progressive efforts as well as African-American voters. And so, you know, it doesn't seem to be the issue that's actually driving the base that's showing up to vote right now. Mm-hmm. For me, I think they can bridge the divide in the short term. But in the long term, I think the question gets more complicated. Yeah. Can the Democratic Party have these conversations in ways that won't alienate a party that might fracture if Trump disappears or if the GOP falls apart? I think that's a question that we're going to see a lot of people grapple with in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, great deal of energy from the women's marches is being directed toward female political candidates, electoral campaigns, toward getting more women elected to public office. How much might the abortion debate slow this momentum down, do you think?
In the short term, I don't think it'll slow it a lot. I genuinely think, you know, this current uptick in activism in the progressive spheres is really sharp and doesn't seem to be caught up as of yet in the issue of abortion. I do think there's a lot of things that went into the Roy Moore, Doug Jones election in Alabama, but I do think a lot of folks are pointing to that to say, you know, there's a lot going on here, and abortion seems to be a minor issue comparatively for a lot of others. Mm-hmm. But I do think this surge in, you know, female candidates and, you know, discussions of women's rights and abortion rights is going to hit a point where you might see prominent female candidates that are in places in the Midwest or in the South who have to ask the question out loud, you know, can I win in southeastern Ohio without tackling this issue head on one way or another? And I think for Democratic strategists, that's the question on the table. It's not that whether or not the majority of Americans support abortion rights. Almost all data indicates that's the case, that the majority of Americans think abortion should be legal in all or most cases. The question is, how do you get the math together for winning these races and winning back the House and the Senate? And when you're looking at difficult conservative districts, I do think it's a question they're going to have to take seriously. Mm-hmm.
If you listened to the rhetoric from both demonstrations this year, would you have heard anything that suggested there might be movement between those two movements with some minor even overlap?
I think you would find them in the very fringes of the crowd. I think there were some reports of some groups that, you know, these are not huge populations with lots of signs, but there are these small slices at gatherings for the Women's March and more often actually at the March for Life, where you have these small, more progressive-oriented people who identify as both pro-life and progressive in a lot of other issues. Usually you'll hear people talk about, in a religious context, what's called a consistent life ethic. They oppose abortion, but they also oppose the death penalty. They also support paid family leave, which are, you know, these more progressive policies. So you do see a little bit of that overlap happening at the corners there, but I don't think you would have heard that from the podium. I think that was harder to hear from either gathering this go-round.
Jack Jenkins is a religion reporter with the Essential Religion News Service, covering critically important stories from a non-sectarian, non-partisan perspective. Jack's important and widely shared article for RNS is headlined, "Anti-Abortion Democrats Navigate Divide Between March for Life and the Women's March," and we'll link to that on stateofbelief.com. Jack, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. Always happy to be here.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from Franciscan Action Network Executive Director Patrick Carolyn on this weekend's multi-faith action in support of American Muslims. And up next, author, attorney, and activist Jay Michelson on the Supreme Court and religious liberty. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. What 2017 started, a trend toward extreme partisanship in two of the three branches of our federal government, and aggressive attempts to politicize the third as never before. For a look at where things currently stand with the Supreme Court and what that's likely to portend for the coming year, I'm joined by attorney, author, and activist Rabbi Jay Michelson. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Great to be back.
I want to congratulate you on your new baby, too.
Thank you.
One of the recent events at the Supreme Court that got some press was declining to take on challenges to the Mississippi Religious Freedom Law. Would you start with a quick explanation of why that state's attempt to institutionalize discrimination is seen as the worst in the nation?
With these religious exemptions laws, it's always a matter of kind of scale and proportion, who's covered and how much is covered. And the Mississippi law just goes further in the nation to really just include just about anybody refusing services for any. And the Supreme Court decided not to hear the challenge at this time, mostly for procedural reasons. I think this still is going to be challenged in court and not sure it's going to survive.
Why do you think it's generated less outrage than many of the RFRAs in places like North Carolina and Indiana?
I think two reasons. First, it's Mississippi, and I think there's an understanding that Mississippi is a little bit different from North Carolina and Indiana, culturally and politically. Second, though, I think we've really reached outrage fatigue. You know, in general, progressives are so outraged about so many things with this administration that, you know, these kinds of laws, they are serious, but it's hard to get any airtime. And even those of us who care about this issue, about religious exemptions and discrimination, we have a lot to choose from. The Sessions Justice Department memo saying they're just not going to enforce civil rights laws. And we'll talk more about some very recent developments on that religious freedom area. So even just in this case, in this little area of the law, there's been more than anyone can handle.
So what is the significance, then, of the court's inaction on this piece?
Well, and immediately, it means the law actually has gone into effect. And that's, you know, that the changes are already there in Mississippi. You know, it's difficult to say on the short-term basis how many people these laws actually impact. They're really more sort of discrimination signs than anything else. Like, you know, this kind of discrimination is okay. I do think, again, without getting in the legal weeds, this was kind of a preliminary challenge before the law even went into effect. So from a lawyer's point of view, it's hard to show what the harm is. Now that the law has been in effect, you know, the left-wing activists are just going to go looking for the right plaintiff who got turned away from business, and the case will wend its way up. It's a setback, but I think the fact that they didn't take this particular case, we shouldn't read too much into.
Jay, has there been enough cumulative evidence up to now to suggest the general direction this court's likely to take on LGBT and religious freedom issues overall?
Well, I think we're really going to find out this term with Masterpiece Cake Shop. That's the first case on this area of law where Justice Gorsuch is on the court. He will certainly follow in lockstep with Justice Scalia's position, probably to the right of Justice Scalia's position. You know, the real question that we all have to be asking is whether Justice Kennedy is going to retire or not after this term. I haven't checked in a couple of months, but as of a couple of months ago, he hadn't hired clerks for the next term. That's worrying. He's the swing vote on all of these issues. He was the swing vote in Hobby Lobby, which was the most important religious freedom case. I remember you and I talking about that at some length. And if that seat is replaced by a more conservative justice rather than a centrist, you know, we're in for it for a number of years, you know, until the next justice leaves or retires. So I think the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, it's a tough one for Justice Kennedy because he is a strong free speech guy. And the way that case came up, this for listeners don't remember, is the Colorado baker who refused to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. That came up actually as a free speech case. And that's a tricky one because it is the government compelling speech of a certain kind. Time, meaning making that cake. And so I'm a little pessimistic in terms of where Justice Kennedy will come out on that case. And certainly that will be an important signpost.
If that ruling does go against us, what's at stake there?
Well, two things. First, and I think most importantly, you know, we've already seen the sticks move, so to speak, in terms of women's and LGBT rights. So we used to be talking about abortion. Now we're talking about contraception. Now we're talking about family planning. And on LGBT, you know, now if this case goes the way it does, the sticks will move. We will have, well, there'll be a next case. So this is a baker. So what about a large company that doesn't want to give employment benefits, let's say, or same-sex spousal benefits to a legally married spouse? Texas already has that policy in place, the state of Texas. So, you know, that's a huge case. That also matters much more economically than just the wedding cake cases. So that's the first major impact is the slope, the slippery slope, what happens next. But secondly, I think, you know, the fact that people in the administration said, yes, you should be allowed to hang a sign that says no gays allowed on your storefront window, that's extremely worrying. And it's just the, you know, there a lot of these laws are symbolic and these cases are symbolic. And that's important. You know, when in the civil rights movement, the right, the same folks who are now arguing for religious exemptions to LGBT argued for religious exemptions to civil rights laws. Mm-hmm. And they lost. And that was an important loss. And it took about 15 years to filter through till the Bob Jones case went all the way into the 1980s, where basically the Supreme Court finally said, no, you can't get an exemption from these civil rights laws. So if you can get an exemption from LGBT civil rights laws, well, that just says those some rights are more equal than others.
We saw the announcement about Health and Human Services and this conscience and religious freedom division. And I wish you would talk about that because I see this as something very significant that's going to impact all of our conversations about LGBT issues.
Well, and not just LGBT, but women's rights as well, and just church-state in general. Look, the so-called new Christian right made the devil's bargain with Donald Trump. They have their man in the vice president's office, and it is payback time, and it's been payback time for all of 2017, and this is another brick in the wall. This is yet another bit of payback for that support that Christian conservatives, you know, they swallowed a whole lot of Christian values to support this guy. And so that culture change is very far-reaching. You know, specifically, what HHS, the Health and Human Services Department, did is set up a new division within the Office of Civil Rights that's just going to pay attention to these conscience-based claims. All departments have to do triage all the time. You know, there's no way any governmental department can enforce every law all of the time. So they make choices, which are the priorities. And This is a very clear statement by the head of the Office of Civil Rights, who's a man named Roger Severino, who talk about kind of putting the fox in charge of the hen house. He was at the Heritage Foundation for a decade arguing for religious exemptions on civil rights laws, especially in Health and Human Services. So it's like taking, you know, the head of the ACLU to head a civil rights law office. This is not somebody who's a moderate figure, someone who's a well-known activist, in this case on the right. And, you know, he said in the ceremony launching the new division that this is now a priority, that the civil rights of religious people wanting to discriminate will be the priority over the civil rights of those that they're discriminating against.
There will be permission for, say, doctors to refuse to give services to LGBTQ people if they say it violates their religion. Is that right?
That's right. And to clarify, that's already the law. So, you congratulated me for the birth of my baby daughter, who's now 6 weeks old. If we take her to the emergency room, a doctor, a nurse, an ambulance driver can refuse services because it offends their religion to treat the child of a same-sex couple. And that's not a hypothetical. There are actual cases where that actually happened, where a pediatrician refused to see the child of a lesbian couple. And so that's already taken place. That's already legal under the religious exemptions. What's new now is that if there's ever any kind of conflict, the Department of Health and Human Services has now chosen sides. They're on the side of that doctor or pharmacist or ambulance driver or nurse or hospital chain or hospital administrator. And it's not just LGBT. It's also anything connected with abortion, but now also anything connected with contraception. So if there's a pharmacist who works for CVS and CVS has a requirement that you have to dispense whatever medications are medically necessary, that pharmacist can now file a complaint with the federal government against CVS, saying this is improper. I shouldn't have to fill this prescription. Now, at CVS, likely there's another pharmacist right there. But if we're talking about smaller towns, places where there might be only one pharmacy in town, that's devastating to women who are seeking contraception care. And once again, it just puts a sign on the door saying, well, contraception might be morally evil, so you don't really have a full right to it. You sort of have a right to it, but not really. And also for transgender folks, people who maybe have been on hormone therapy, let's say, for many years, and now a pharmacist says, well, I don't believe that, the scientific community is right. I think transgender doesn't exist. Then they won't fill that prescription. So this has immediate consequences. And again, having this office to protect the rights of the people who are doing the discriminating just means the government's taking sides.
What other Supreme Court cases are you paying very close attention to in the weeks ahead?
Well, my closest attention is on the pair of voting rights cases, one of which was just heard last week at the Supreme Court. The other was heard back in the fall. The one last week was about Ohio voter purging, where if you don't vote in two elections, that starts a process that gets you thrown off the rolls. And also there was a challenge to gerrymandering in Wisconsin that was extreme partisan gerrymandering. Voter suppression is really where it's at right now. And that is, everybody knows the demographics that, if everybody votes proportionally, Donald Trump will be the last president of his kind in this country's history, meaning of that kind of older guard of the hard right and however far you want to go in characterizing Donald Trump. So there's a lot of folks who are determined to not let demographics have their way. And so that's what I'm watching the most. And in particular, I have to say, I'm really watching how churches and religious organizations are coming out on this issue. Like a lot of issues, there's a claim on the other side that, well, there's all this voter fraud and we have to stop voter fraud. That claim is false. It's just some things are a matter of opinion, but some are a matter of fact. And it is not true that there is a large voter fraud problem in the country. But a lot of churches are buying it. And, a lot of people churches used to be helping people to vote. And it's interesting to see how some religious organizations are now siding with making it harder for people to vote and sometimes saying so explicitly. And that's actually what I'm watching most at the Supreme Court, to see if they're going to take a stand to protect voting rights.
Does the high court's approach to voting rights help us predict what its stand on other race-related cases might be?
Yes and no. Voting rights is really, everybody on right, left, center will agree that the court's jurisprudence is kind of a mess. It's really all over the place. And I went to the Supreme Court to hear that Wisconsin case argued in person. And, the court has said, well, some gerrymandering is too partisan, but we're not really going to say what that is. And so this case was, they had all the statistical data showing that how partisan it was, how extreme it was. But just Chief Justice Roberts in particular was very skeptical. I mean, he just said, well, so okay, so 0.10 is okay, but 0.13 is not okay. And that just is a sign of messy jurisprudence. And so it's very hard to know even how they're going to come out on these cases, let alone how that impacts. But I think, you know, if we look to Justice Gorsuch as the type of justice who we would see next, if there were another nomination coming soon, you know, he is to the right of everybody except maybe Justice Thomas. So, you know, on a number of cases, for example, on the employment issue after same-sex marriage. So there was a little case that went along and the court declined to take a case that would have limited same-sex marriage rights. Justice Gorsuch wrote separately to say, oh, no, marriage may not mean everything marriage. Some marriages can be more equal than others. So that's extremely disturbing. He also sort of questioned the use of the whole foundation of the Voting Rights Act. In that voting rights case in Wisconsin, suggesting that maybe the whole thing should be thrown out, which wasn't even at issue. So I do think we can look to him, certainly, as defining the far right in a way that we haven't seen. And he's a lot more articulate than Justice Thomas. He's a lot more outspoken. And so it's Gorsuch and then Thomas, and then Alito is much more like Justice Scalia used to be. So hard right, but you know, much more intellectual rigor. And that is the future of the Supreme Court.
Jay, just a couple of years ago, the conventional wisdom was that the political religious right, having lost the culture wars at home, was busily exporting them overseas. We saw this play out in places like Russia and Uganda, among others. Are you concerned about the re-empowerment of theocrats at home, and what do you see coming for human rights, particularly LGBTQ rights, abroad?
Well, overseas, during the Obama administration, there were kind of two sides to this fight. So the Obama administration was supporting not just LGBT, but human rights in general, pro-democracy organizations and so on. And that was the policy of the United States. And then the other side was, as you've indicated, sort of theocratic, again, so-called Christian right organizations, partnering with Putin in Russia and the World Congress of Families, which listeners should definitely Google if they haven't heard of that, to kind of ensure that international law does not include liberated women and LGBT people. So now, a year later, there's only one side in the fight because the Trump administration has just withdrawn. They're cutting off all of the funding that supported those organizations. They basically said that human rights law shouldn't trump various national laws, that states have a right to their own self-determination, which is a code word for saying no human rights law. And to the extent that they're on LGBT, they're on the more conservative side. So now there's only one side in the fight, and they haven't let up the efforts that they're undertaking overseas. So we're seeing 100 Ugandas all across the world where now there's nobody on the other side. And so this administration has abandoned activists on the human rights side who we've worked with, we the United States has worked with for many years. And that leaves them open to both government discrimination, but also discrimination and violence that's coming from America and being exported to these other countries. Even before President Trump's love affair with Vladimir Putin, there were Christian right organizations that were in love with him and who were partnering with them to write legislation around the world in various different countries. And that is now happening without any organized opposition.
Are Roe v. Wade and Obergefell safe?
Not at all. I think right now there aren't the votes to overturn either of those two decisions outright. But it's the death of 1,000 blows. You know, in many parts of the country, it's harder for a woman to get an abortion today than it was when Roe versus Wade was decided. Even though there's the constitutional guarantee, there are all kinds of restrictions that have been put into place since then. And that's the roadmap for same-sex marriage. So if, you know, regardless of our own personal, you know, moral views, if we think it's a good thing for government to be enforcing religious views, well, that's what's happening. And so even if Obergefell, which the same-sex marriage case stands, it can be chipped away. So what is a marriage if any hotel can turn me away, you know, and say we can't have a room together, or if any company can deny me health insurance coverage for my legally same-sex marriage spouse? You know, it sort of chips and chips and chips away to the point where the right isn't really there anymore. And that you don't have to fantasize about what that would look like. You just look to abortion rights. And as we said earlier, the sticks move. So first we're talking about abortion, then we're talking about contraception. And so it's not a new playbook, but it is a new team. And the fact that these folks, activists like Roger Severino, are now calling the shots in government, anyone who thought that, well, maybe this wouldn't be so bad for women and LGBT people, you can't think that anymore.
Working at the unusual intersection of politics and spirituality, Rabbi Jay Michelson is an author, an attorney, an activist. He is a meditation teacher, and his writing appears regularly in the Daily Beast, The Forward, and elsewhere. Rabbi Michelson's books include The Gate of Tears, Sadness, and the Spiritual Path, and God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. Jay, thanks for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure. Keep doing your good work.
Donald Trump first promised a total and complete ban on Muslims entering the United States, a nation with as strong a prohibition on religious discrimination as any nation on earth, while campaigning for president. January 27th marks 1 year since this president kept that horrific campaign promise, or tried to anyway. Delays and court challenges have not prevented millions from having lives disrupted and plans upended, as well as dignity trampled and fears inflamed. A multi-faith coalition is stepping up to stand with our beleaguered Muslim sisters and brothers, and I am joined now by one of the leaders, Franciscan Action Network Executive Director Patrick Carolyn. Patrick, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
What's taking place January 27th in Washington, D.C.?
That is the first anniversary of, and hopefully the last anniversary, of the Muslim ban that President Trump initiated. And so our plan is that there's a large group of people, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, and other faith traditions as well, going to be gathering. We're going to have a rally, and we're going to circle the White House. We're going to have a prayer vigil circling the White House. You know, we were firm believers in God, and we're firm believers in transformation, and we're hoping that with all of our prayers together, the president can sort of see the evil that he's doing and error of his ways and start to transform into being a person that he said he was.
Talk about the different Muslim groups taking part in the action, if you would.
The action is organized by Shoulder to Shoulder, which brings together Muslim and Christian communities. The Islamic Society of North America is one, and others, as well as a number of Christian groups that will be there. And, you know, we'll be there to Sisters of Mercy. We'll be there to be a number of Catholic organizations and other Christian communities. We have to speak truth to power. Right. And so we have to speak out, but we also have to speak out in such a way that we're not personally attacking the other, because that just puts us on the same level as the other. We have to be above that as people of faith. We have to believe that transformation can happen. My organization has been working with the Muslim community for the past 2 years. We've been working for a long time, but there's a whole history of St. Francis of Assisi, who went to the Emiato, Egypt, in the 12th century, and this was during the Fifth Crusade, and he went to try to promote peace. And so he went and first met with the Christian armies and then found his way into the Muslim camp and became friends with Sultan al-Kamil, who was the leader of the Muslim armies, and helped bring about peace and helped bring about the end to the Fifth Crusade. So there's a long history of relationship and peace building between the Muslim communities and the Franciscans.
What are the ongoing initiatives around standing with Muslims in the face of discrimination that they're facing from this president?
One initiative that we're doing, again, is around the film The Sultan and the Saint.
Mm-hmm.
It was shown on public television December 26th. I listened to your segment on that.
Oh, good.
But, you know, we didn't want this to be a one-off where people watch it and said, oh, this is a nice film. We wanted this to be a vehicle to bring people together to start talking about, you know, we always ask the question, where today, who is the St. Francis today, who is the Sultan today, who has the willingness and the courage to speak out and to come together to build relationships. Mm-hmm. Where are those people today? It's nice to look at this from a historical perspective. It's better to look at it today and say, am I that person? Am I willing to take that risk and step out? And both of these men, by the way, took a risk to meet each other and be in relationship with each other. So part of what we're planning on doing is across the country to try to build these small communities where Muslim and Christians come together and, you know, both build relationships together, celebrate together, but offer rapid response to protect each other. Hmm. We've seen this. There's a whole project that's been going on in Africa called the Damietto Initiative. It was started by Franciscans in South Africa, and it's all around bringing people together, Muslim and Christians together, building relationships with each other, and then being there to protect each other as a rapid response in case something happens. Hmm. So we're trying to build that up here in the United States as well. You know, the other things that are going on is we're all working toward changing the legislation. I mean, it's just absolutely unacceptable to be a nation that welcomes the strangers to reduce the number of refugees that can come in to 15,000. That's outrageous. And people who have been waiting for 2 years, have been properly vetted, now may not get into this country. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at that and change those. And, you know, and part of that is then making this an issue when people vote.
Yeah.
Are you voting for people? Are you voting for folks who are willing to welcome strangers, to care for the poor and the hungry? Or are you voting for people who just want to give tax cuts to the wealthy and corporations? That's a question. I always ask the question, and I tell people, these are not political issues. This is a moral issue. And this is one of those issues that defines, as a nation, are we a moral nation or are we not? We claim to be a moral nation, but our actions tell us that we're not. And we have to get back to being a moral nation. And, you know, as a Christian, I get angry that my faith is being hijacked by people who are promoting hatred, fear, and bigotry. And so as a Christian, I have to speak out and say, enough is enough. We have to stop promoting fear and hatred and bigotry and start promoting what the message of the gospel is, a message of love and peace.
It seems the only faith voices reaching the Oval Office right now come from the political religious right. What gives you hope that the group you lead and other faith-inspired groups standing with Muslims will be heard by the administration?
The only faith voices that are being heard are people who are promoting a message of fear and hate and a message of bigotry. And we can't claim to be a moral nation if that's what we're preaching. Mm-hmm. And people can't claim to be Christians if that's what they're preaching. Mm-hmm. We're just going to keep shouting from the mountaintop about this. Change doesn't happen from the top down. It happens from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that there's more and more groundswell, and we've seen this with other marches, we've seen this with this movement, that more and more people take to the streets and more people start really raising the issue and saying, are we a moral nation? Are we a nation, a sacred ground that welcomes folks and cares for people? Or are we a nation that's going to build walls around the border and be exclusive and not let anyone in? You know, who are we? And those are the kind of questions we have to ask our political leaders. And when folks are running for office, we have to start asking them that over and over again. And we have to start challenging our political leaders and our elected officials. And I, you know, I do this all the time. I tell them to please stop claiming to be Catholic to some of our Catholic leaders. Yes. When you're not really following the teachings of Jesus.
Yeah. Listen, briefly, before we get off, talk about the Franciscan Action Network and the other issues you're working on and how our listeners can stay informed about your work.
So we are an organization that is made up of all of the different branches of the Franciscan family. There are a lot of different Franciscans. We're actually an ecumenical organization because there's whole orders of Episcopalian Franciscans, there's Lutheran Franciscans, there's ecumenical Franciscans, and there's also large groups of people who are Franciscan-hearted people. They're not professed Franciscans, but they live by the spirit of St. Francis of Assisi, and we come together to work on social justice, looking at it through the vision, through the lens of Franciscan spirituality. And Franciscan spirituality is all about being in relationship with all of creation.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And if you're in relationship with all of creation, you wouldn't do anything to destroy creation. And so we work on issues like immigration. We've been working on climate justice for a long time. We've been one of the leading faith groups that work on that issue. We work on issues like the peacekeeping and the Muslim-Christian relations and trying to fend off Islamophobia. We've also been involved more recently in a whole issue of racism and trying to raise awareness on that. So any of these kinds of issues, we're based in Washington, D.C., but we have folks all over the country that are part of the organization. Our website is franciscanaction.org. If you want more info, you can send an email to info@franciscanaction.org. We work in collaboration and coalition with other faith groups in D.C. There's a whole faith community that works together on immigration and refugees issues. There's another faith community that works on environmental issues. So we all the different faiths come together in D.C. to work on these issues together. And then we work with secular groups on the issues as well. And we work to raise awareness and just bring that voice of what, as I often tell people, as a Christian, I ask a simple question. Do you think Jesus came with a building plan or an evacuation plan? Because most of our theology is based on evacuation. You're going to go someplace else, heaven or hell. And everything Jesus talked about was building the kingdom of heaven here on earth. And if that's what Jesus told us, then maybe we should start building the kingdom of heaven here on earth.
Patrick Carolyn is Executive Director of the Franciscan Action Network. On the anniversary of the first Trump executive order banning Muslims from traveling into the United States, the network joins a broad multi-faith coalition to stand with our Muslim sisters and brothers in front of the White House, from which this fear and hate-mongering has been emanating. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
And thank you, and thank you for all that you do to raise awareness to these issues.
Before we go, our nation is being flogged to death by lies. Consequently, America is dealing with a serious trust crisis. Over the past two decades, I regularly have monitored the shifting levels of truth and trust in our nation, as measured by polling data from Gallup, Pew, Public Religion Research Center, and Edelman. Seldom have there been high levels of trust, but the 2018 Edelman Global Trust Barometer highlights what he calls the battle for truth that is raging around the world and warns us of crisis in trust that must be addressed immediately. Edelman documents a devastating 37-point aggregate decline in people's trust of institutions, all institutions. The decline of trust in the United States is the steepest ever measured. The most dramatic decline of trust in the United States occurred in the public's lack of trust in government. Well, that's not surprising, given the fact that the most consistent behavioral trait of our president is lying. Fewer than one in three people trust the United States government. No longer is the government considered an effective force in leading change. But Americans' trust in other realms is not much better. This past year, trust in media plummeted to an all-time low. Around the world, trust in media declined in 80% of the countries surveyed. Globally, 85% of the people polled lacked full belief in the basic systems of government, society, business, and the like. Trust in companies headquartered in the United States dropped from 55 to 50% last year. Out of the 28 countries surveyed, The United States is in last place among the level of trust in nations. China now has the highest trust index among the nations of the world. Changing the reality of pervasive distrust will not be easy. At stake here is confidence in the business world, faith in religions, and vitality and security in our democracy. Dare we allow any further erosion of trust in our land? This year's Edelman Report begins with these words, I'm quoting, "The U.S. has reached a point of crisis that should provoke every leader in government, business, or civil sector into urgent action. The public's confidence in the traditional structures of American leadership is now fully undermined and has been replaced with a strong sense of fear, uncertainty, and disillusionment. History tells us that a world or a nation devoid of trust is destined for disarray and decline in virtually all, if not all, sectors of public life." I'm reminded of a conversation I had one day with my dear friend Walter Cronkite, who at that time was known as the most trusted man in America. He and I were discussing the low rate of trust in Congress. "What has to happen, Walter," I asked, "for that to change?" After a long pause, Cronkite said, "It would help a lot if they would just tell the truth." So it is for government, all of government, and so it is for life. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief this weekend, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We want you engaged in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.